From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Closing arguments in the court hearing on whether to grant a new trial for Geronimo Pratt. We'll review the original murder verdict and what role the FBI's counterintelligence program played in the targeting of the former Black Panther. Then back to the confirmation hearings of Anthony Lake as director of Central Intelligence.
I'll just name a few views here, and you tell me whether or not you agree with these. Number one, that U.S. should not intervene militarily anywhere unless invited. Number two, the Soviet Union never contemplated attacking the West. Number three, there was nothing wrong about releasing the Pentagon Papers. Number four, all U.S. covert activities should be illegal. On these four, do you agree with them?
Senator, I haven't seen the context of all those statements, but as you present them to me, I wouldn't agree with any of the four.
We'll talk with Daniel Ellsberg, the man who released the Pentagon Papers. Then Anthony Lake and Jennifer Harbury on human rights abusers on the CIA payroll.
Here we have to balance the advantage to our national interest by gaining this individual as an intelligence source versus the embarrassment or disrepute he could bring to our government, especially at a time when these things can become such public issues.
You know, we're talking about the Charles Mansons of this hemisphere, highly serious criminal activity that have resulted in thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, civilians, being massacred and tortured and kidnapped at the most grotesque level of human rights abuses.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal investigation into whether the Chinese government had a concerted plan to influence American officeholders began early last year when the National Security Agency surreptitiously monitored a series of communications between Beijing and Chinese officials in the United States. This according to law enforcement representatives. I'm reading from the front page of the New York Times today. Those conversations, the law enforcement officials said, offered a fragmentary sketch of China's interest in matching the Washington lobbying success of its rival Taiwan, and also suggested that Beijing was prepared to take a drastic step, funneling money to American politicians in violation of U.S. law. As a result, the Times reports, the officials said, the Federal Bureau of Investigation prepared a list of about 30 members of Congress who the Bureau thought might be subjects of the Chinese effort. But for reasons that remain unclear, the FBI advised only half a dozen of them in private meetings last June. Even after national security officials warned that he should be treated with suspicion, Democratic donor Chani Chung returned to the White House 17 times, mostly visiting the First Lady's offices. Eight of the visits came after a second cautionary memo was directed to President Clinton's then-National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, warning aides to be very careful about granting Chung political favors. Lake's nomination to head the CIA is now under scrutiny in the Senate. The initial National Security Council memo cautioning that Chung was bringing Chinese associates into the White House to enhance his own business interests was forwarded to a staff assistant in the president's office. This, according to a senior White House official speaking on condition of anonymity to the Associated Press. White House Special Counsel Lonnie Davis declined to say who saw the memo, but acknowledged the NSC, quote, gave, when asked, pretty good counsel that should have been more closely heeded by presidential aides. This in the front page of the Washington Post today. Four planned receptions for wealthy Democratic financial benefactors to meet with President Clinton at the White House have been scrapped in recent weeks out of concern that they would only deepen the political damage from the ongoing furor over campaign money. The Washington Post goes on to say two top party fundraisers said they were told by White House officials that First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton declared the mansion out of bounds for events intended to stroke deep-pocketed donors. Aides to the president confirmed that Hillary Clinton's staff weighed in on the matter, but characterized the decision as a consensus throughout the White House that the timing was bad. Maligned for failing to catch moles, attacked for involvement with killers, The CIA suffers from an undeservedly bad reputation and an internal morale problem, says Anthony Lake, who awaits confirmation to head the spy service. The secret shroud around the CIA prevents Americans from seeing the agency's accomplishments, such as thwarting terrorists, Lake told the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday in the second day of his confirmation hearings. Instead, the focus is on failures, such as the Aldrich Ames spy case and the charges that the CIA aided murderous military officers in Latin American wars. More on that story later in the show. The Army is rejecting a call by the NAACP and the Congressional Black Caucus for an outside probe into the service's own investigations of sexual harassment within its ranks. "I think we have oversight enough," Army Secretary Togo West told reporters yesterday. The calls for an independent probe came in the wake of charges by five white female soldiers that Army investigators had tried to get them to falsely charge their superiors, many of whom are black, with rape. Both West and Kwame Mfume, who met at the Pentagon, said they had a cordial meeting in which they agreed on the need to fully pursue any charges of sexual harassment. House Republicans are moving toward another showdown with President Clinton on a bill that would outlaw so-called partial birth abortions. Republicans lost the fight last year when President Clinton vetoed similar legislation. The House voted to override, but the Senate did not. On Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee voted 20-11 to send the bill to the House floor, where it was expected to be taken up next week. Sponsors think they have the momentum on their side, this time because of the recent statement by abortion rights advocate Ron Fitzsimmons that he lied about the timing and reasons why women undergo the procedure. Fitzsimmons, executive director of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers in Alexandria, Virginia, has said the procedure, which critics call partial birth abortion, was more common than he originally stated and not always done to protect a woman's health or save her life. Expecting defeat in the House, President Clinton is counting on the Senate to back his decision to recertify Mexico as a full partner in the war on drugs. Despite a sure presidential veto and a growing willingness in the Senate to let Clinton's two-week-old decision on Mexico stand, the House was voting today on a resolution declaring that Mexico has not been cooperating in the anti-drug fight. A version of the measure was approved 27-5 by the House International Relations Committee a week ago. The resolution declares Mexico uncooperative in the anti-drug fight, but allows Clinton to waive sanctions, an option he already has. And this news also on the front page of the New York Times today. Nigeria's military government has charged a Nobel laureate, Wole Soyinka, with treason after a series of bombings at army sites. 11 other dissidents have been charged. A celebrated playwright, Mr. Soyinka, may be Nigeria's most prominent dissident. If convicted, he could face the death penalty, but since he is living in exile, he is unlikely to face the full weight of Nigerian law. Still, he likened his situation to the death sentence imposed by the Iranian government on the writer Salman Rushdie. Nigeria's military ruler, General Sani Abacha, drew international condemnation for the execution more than a year ago of another prominent author, Ken Saro-Wiwa. And you may remember that we did have Wole Soyinka on Democracy Now! Just a month ago. And I want to remind you folks, as we continue to bring you the campaign finance news, that we are continuing to offer our mugs to the White House. If you call in and want a mug sent in your name, that mug with a message that says to President Clinton, "Coffee, tea, and me." The idea that President Clinton has been meeting with Chinese arms merchants, corporate moguls, and others, what about us? And you can send that mug to President Clinton that says Democracy Now! And Dear President Clinton, Coffee, Tea, and Me. If you call our 800 number, you can also get one for yourself. You can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. The end of the personalized letter that President Clinton gets, signed in your name, says, "I welcome the equal opportunity to share my thoughts with you in person. Coffee, Tea, and Me. Democracy Now!" And then it offers President Clinton your address so that he can send you an invitation. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Former Black Panther Party leader Geronimo Pratt has been fighting for 26 years to get a new trial. He was convicted in 1972 of shooting teacher Carolyn Olson to death and critically wounding her husband during a 1968 robbery that netted $18 on a Santa Monica tennis court. Supporters and attorneys of Pratt say that he's innocent of the charge and that he was at a top-level Panther meeting in Oakland at the time. And they insist that Pratt was the victim of the FBI's counterintelligence program that targeted Black Panthers. Indeed, the key prosecution witness at his trial, Julius Butler, was an FBI informant. Today in Santa Monica, closing arguments begin in the hearing that will determine whether to grant Geronimo Pratt a new trial. Here to update us on the situation is Ed Boyer, a Los Angeles Times staff reporter who's been covering the case of Geronimo Pratt extensively. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ed.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, why don't you, before telling us about, you know, what is going to happen today in the court with Johnny Cochran and the prosecution presenting their closing arguments, can you go back in time for us, for listeners who aren't so familiar with Geronimo Pratt's case, and lay out for us what happened, going back to 1968?
Well, in 1968, Geronimo Pratt was recently been discharged from the service where he had served in Vietnam, and he was a decorated war veteran. Pratt was from Louisiana, moved to Los Angeles, and entered UCLA. There he met leaders of the Los Angeles branch of the Panthers, joined the party in late 1968, and by his accounts, had gone to Oakland for party meetings in December of 68. And on December 18th, however, a young couple, Caroline Olson and her husband Kenneth, had met to play tennis on courts in Santa Monica. Two gunmen approached them, robbed them, and shot them both. Caroline Olson was fatally wounded, her husband wounded critically. About a year and a half later, after Pratt had been elevated to a leadership post in the Southern California Panthers, a former Los Angeles County deputy sheriff by the name of Julius Butler. Butler is now a Los Angeles attorney, and he's chairman of the board of perhaps the most prominent African-American congregation here in Los Angeles. Butler felt that his life was being threatened by Panthers, and he turned a so-called insurance letter over to over to Los Angeles police officers, saying that Pratt had confessed to him that he had committed this robbery and murder in Santa Monica, and that was the first link, authorities say, that they had tying Pratt to the crime. Pratt was eventually arrested, tried in 1972 when he was convicted. The jury, after some 10 days, convicted him of the murder. Since that time, at least three of the jurors have said they would not have voted to convict him had they known that Butler had been providing information to law enforcement. Butler denied on the stand that he had, in his words, that he had ever in the world been a snitch. But documents released under the Freedom of Information Act showed that Butler had been providing information to FBI agents for the better part of more than 2 years prior to Pratt's trial. That's a big part of this current hearing on Pratt's petition for habeas corpus. It's his petition to have his conviction overturned. There was a very dramatic development this past summer when the district attorney's office began looking through its own files of confidential informants, and Butler's name turned up. He told a district attorney's investigator that he, in fact, had been paid. He had received something of value in return for information, and that being gun or money for a gun. He later recanted that statement, saying that the investigator had taken it down incorrectly. So now we're at a point where there has been a 17-day hearing. This is it is without question the most complete hearing Pratt has had since he was convicted in 1972. It is his fifth attempt to get a petition of habeas corpus granted. And today, Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran, Pratt's attorneys, will do final arguments in a hearing in Santa Ana, California, down in Orange County, where the case had to be moved because a Los Angeles Superior Court judge was a witness.
Can you explain who Richard P. Is it Calustian was the Los Angeles Superior Court judge?
Richard P. Calustian is the Los Angeles Superior Court judge. He was the deputy district attorney who prosecuted Pratt in 1972. He was called as a witness in this hearing because Pratt's attorneys have long felt that the prosecution knowingly put on perjured testimony in the form of Butler's denials that he had ever been an informant. That issue... Calustian has consistently denied that, and that issue was really not resolved. Calustian did acknowledge that he knew that Butler, then a convicted felon, carried a pistol, and he thought that was fully justified because he thought that Butler needed that because he thought his life was in danger.
We're talking to Ed Boyer, who is a Los Angeles Times staff reporter who has been covering this perhaps more extensively than any reporter in the United States. Now, today, what do you think Johnny Cochran is going to be focusing on? First of all, this is a case I know that Johnny Cochran considers very important. I saw him over at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago this summer and went up to him and asked him about the Geronimo Pratt case, and he said, "This is the most important case of my career." He didn't know about any of the FBI information, any of the cooperation of Julius Butler and authorities at the time of the trial, did he?
No, he didn't. I mean, there are a good many things that Cochran didn't know, and as a result, the jury didn't know it. And this tragic killing, the woman's husband survived. He positively identified Pratt at trial as the killer. But what Cochran didn't know and what the jury did not know is that he had previously positively identified someone else in a lineup. Now, those two conflicting identifications would have worked in Pratt's favor. We're talking about identification almost 3 years after the crime at the trial. Cochran has always said that this is the case that would not allow him to retire from law. But Stuart Hanlon from San Francisco has also been an attorney who has been very much involved with this case since Pratt's conviction. Hanlon began as a third-year law student, and he's still involved. I have a piece in today's paper discussing Hanlon's role in this case. But they're going to focus on what they feel were, they're going to focus on testimony in the original trial, elements in the original trial, that they should have been aware of, that they were not able to put before the jury, and that had the jury had this information, they might have reached a different verdict. And that's going to relate to Butler to a large degree. It's going to also relate to other law enforcement officials. Their contention is that they knew that Butler was an informant, that there were FBI agents who knew that, whether you use the word informant or not, and there has been a great debate over, is he or is he not an informant, or is he a source, or is he a contact? And there has been this semantic wrestling with the term. But Pratt's attorneys will take the position that regardless of what you call him, he had a relationship with law enforcement that they should have been aware of. And as a result, the jury would have been made aware of that.
You know, in addition, law enforcement, and you've written about this in a number of your pieces, was closely monitoring Geronimo Pratt. Now, what about intercepts and phone taps of where Geronimo Pratt was? He says he was in Oakland at a Panther meeting, and that he always, when he was away, called into Panther headquarters in Los Angeles because he headed that organization.
That has been the central issue in Pratt's earlier efforts to get out of jail. The allegation that FBI had phone taps on the Panther headquarters in Los Angeles, and that those logs of those taps would show that Pratt was calling from the Bay Area, Oakland or San Francisco, at the time of this murder. The FBI has consistently denied this there were any logs or any such phone tap, although there have been investigators who say they had seen such logs in San Francisco. That is another one of those issues that has never been resolved. But this hearing, interestingly enough, did not go into FBI spying, the infamous COINTELPRO program. Stuart Hanlon made a very, very conscious decision to stay away from the political conspiracy elements of this case. He said, let's just focus on what happened to this man. Let's look at whether he received due process. And that's where they've tried to focus. And by his account, they are much more optimistic now than they have ever been.
When will the judge rule?
When will he rule? That I'm not certain of. I think he will announce that today.
Hmm.
Final arguments will wrap up today, and I'm told from what I'm told about this judge, he will not take a long time. There was an earlier hearing, a very, very limited hearing a few years ago in federal court, and that magistrate took 10.5 months to rule. This judge has a very, very big trial. The assistant treasurer of Orange County is being tried on criminal charges connected with the Orange County bankruptcy, and they're in jury selection now. I don't expect that the judge will take a long time, but how long is a short time? Is it 3 weeks? Is it a month? I really don't know.
Well, Ed Boyer, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning and updating us on the situation. We hope, if we possibly can, through technological feats, to bring the closing arguments or excerpts of them to our listeners tomorrow on Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.
Very good talking to you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, and when we come back, we're going to go to another set of hearings, the hearings that are taking place on Capitol Hill on the confirmation of Anthony Lake to be Director of Central Intelligence. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Today is the third day of the Senate Intelligence Committee's confirmation hearings on President Clinton's nominee for Director of Central Intelligence, Anthony Lake. Led by Alabama Republican Richard Shelby, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, senators have fired questions at Lake about everything from the baseball team he supports to Iranian arms shipments to Bosnia. Notably absent from the discussion, however, has been any mention of the CIA role in international narcotics trafficking or the CIA's support for anti-democratic and repressive military regimes. Still, conservative Republicans on the committee have repeatedly attacked Lake about his managerial experience, integrity, and political beliefs. At times, the hearing had an aura of McCarthyite loyalty hearings from the 1950s. Among the issues that came up in yesterday's hearing was Lake's resignation, along with four colleagues from Henry Kissinger's National Security Council staff in the early 1970s in protest of the invasion of Cambodia. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma also fired questions about Lake's views on communism and the release of the so-called Pentagon Papers in the early 1970s. In a minute, we'll be joined by Daniel Ellsberg, a former State Department and Pentagon official who worked with Anthony Lake during the Vietnam War era. It was Ellsberg who released politicians and the press, the Pentagon Papers, 7,000 pages of top-secret documents on the history of decision-making during the Vietnam War. But first, let's hear an excerpt from yesterday's hearings between Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma and nominee Anthony Lake. Here, Senator Inhofe asks Anthony Lake about his resignation in the early 1970s from Henry Kissinger's National Security Council staff in protest of the invasion of Cambodia.
Is it fair to say that you resigned primarily from the, this is going back to the Kissinger discussion that we had, someone else had with you yesterday, was primarily for policy reasons, that you were motivated by your strongly, even passionately held policy views in opposition to the president's policy at that time?
Senator, I had, as I said yesterday, with some bitterness concluded that the war in Vietnam was a mistake and that we could not win it, not as a military matter. And the fact is that the United States was never militarily defeated in Vietnam, but because as a political matter, the Saigon government had never been placed in a position in which it could survive. Well, that was a very bitter conclusion. I made no secret of that view when I was working with Dr. Kissinger on Vietnam almost every day.
Yes, I understand
his,
that.
He, to his credit, wanted to hear my views on that. When I resigned, it was not simply because I disagreed with the policy. I had been disagreeing with the policy for some months before, but had welcomed the opportunity to work with Dr. Kissinger and others because it was a chance to offer my views and to work on something I cared very much about. I resigned because I thought we were making an ill-considered mistake in moving into Cambodia, which I thought would deepen our problem rather than help resolve it.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I just merely asked the question, was it because of your deeply held passionate views that this took place? And I think you've answered the questions, and I think even to the extent that you did some public demonstration against the war at that time.
I do not recall demonstrating against the war.
Let me read an article.
I wrote about it, but I did not. I don't recall demonstrating.
I'll read this so you can be accurately into the record. This came from an article or a book that you wrote. I'm not sure which one. It's called Coming of Age Through Vietnam. One day before my resignation, I went out between the park buses encircling the White House and joined friends at a demonstration protesting the invasion. At that time, you're talking about of Cambodia. Sat and listened to the songs and speeches. That would imply to me that you are out demonstrating or joining those who demonstrated. And some people like to demonstrate on different things.
Well, sir, this is before I resigned, in fact, while I was still a government official, not afterwards.
You were demonstrating while you were still a government official?
I was not demonstrating. I went out literally, as I said. I knew people who were demonstrating. Indeed, my wife demonstrated, and I respected her for doing it, even if I wasn't thrilled. And I went out and talked to them.
That's fine. That's fine.
That to me is...
What?
Okay.
That's fine. That answers my question. One of your associates at the Nixon White House who followed you into service at the Clinton White House, who apparently was a friendship for quite some time, was Morton Halperin. Somewhat controversial, I might add. But is it fair to say that you hired did you hire Mr. Halperin?
Yes, sir, I did.
Is it fair to say that you hired him at the NSC staff because you're generally comfortable with Mr. Halperin's views?
No, the reason I hired Mr. Halperin was because he's a highly competent official, and I thought he could do work, good work at the NSC staff as he
did. Would you disagree with his views?
Senator, if I may say so, I, as a general practice, have not hired people because of their political views. And in fact, I should state very clearly that on a number of occasions at staff meetings and in other contexts, I have told members of the NSC, most of whom are career officials, that I didn't want to know what their politics were because their job was to do a good job on national security issues, not pursue political
Well, of course, in this case, you knew what his policies and his beliefs and his views were, because everyone else knew it. Did you agree with his views, or you generally agree with them?
I had sometimes agreed. I can recall
well,
sometimes.
Well, I'll just name a few views here, and
disagreed.
You tell me whether or not you agree with these. Mm-hmm. One of his views, number one, that U.S. should not intervene militarily anywhere unless invited. Number two, the Soviet Union never contemplated attacking the West. Number three, there was nothing wrong about releasing the Pentagon Papers. Number four, all U.S. covert activities should be illegal. On these four, do you agree with him?
Senator, I haven't seen the context of all those statements, but as you present them to me, I wouldn't agree with any of the four.
All right.
That doesn't mean I don't believe that Mort Halperin was not a very competent official.
Mr. Lake, during the Reagan and Bush administrations, is it fair to say that you were strongly opposed to many of their foreign policies or defense policies?
If you've reviewed my writings, Senator, you may know that sometimes I disagreed and sometimes I actually agreed, which I think was unusual for...
Let me name a few of them here and tell me whether you agreed or disagree. When Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire, did you agree with that?
I don't recall agreeing or disagreeing with it. If you're asking, I mean, at the time, publicly in writings, I don't know. If you're asking whether I believe that communism... was evil, I agree. If you're asking,
okay, I was
going to
go.
Empire,
we're using up more time because the answers are longer than I had anticipated. And Mr. Chairman, just to
I'll
finish
give you
this
five
line,
minutes
could
of
I
my next
could,
round.
And I take it off my next round? Would
I'll
you?
I'll give you five of mine.
Well, thank you. I like that better. Another one. SDI. Did you agree with that at the time? Just yes or no?
No, sir.
Invasion. The 1983 invasion of Grenada.
At the time, I don't recall taking a position. In retrospect, I think it was a good thing.
How about the Reagan Doctrine, and that is providing military aid to democratic resistance? I'm talking about Angola, Afghanistan, Nicaragua.
Some cases, yes, and some cases, no.
Well, in those three cases, did you?
Angola, I did not agree. Nicaragua, I did not agree. What was the third?
Afghanistan.
I agreed. In fact, that began under the Carter administration.
That was Anthony Lake responding to questions from Oklahoma Republican James Inhofe. And right here I have in front of me the Congressional Quarterly's Politics in America, 1996, 104th Congress, describing Mr. Inhofe. By the way, he succeeded retiring Democratic Senator David Boren of Oklahoma. And it says Inhofe's trademark has been his outspokenness. In 1972, he said that Senator George McGovern of South Dakota should be hanged with Jane Fonda after McGovern, the Democratic presidential nominee, implied that U.S. soldiers had committed atrocities in Vietnam. As a House freshman, Inhofe told crowds that Congress was home to a bunch of communists and communist sympathizers. More recently, he's referred to the Environmental Protection Agency and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration as Gestapo bureaucracies, contending that government overregulation was not just hampering, but destroying business. Well, that was an interaction that took place yesterday, the second day of the confirmation hearings of Anthony Lake as director of Central Intelligence. And joining us right now to talk about his comments are my co-host Lou Wolfe, who's been co-hosting the hearings with me. Lou Wolfe, who is the co-founder of Covert Action Quarterly that looks at U.S. intelligence activities here and abroad. And our guest is Daniel Ellsberg, the man who released the Pentagon Papers, worked for the State Department, worked for the Pentagon, and eventually quit and got out the U.S. designs and plans in the Vietnam War to the major newspapers of this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dan Ellsberg.
Nice to be here, Annie.
Well, your reaction to Anthony Lake, a man you know, who you have associated with over the years, to the questions about whether he agreed with the release of the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I don't think anybody who gave a different answer to that, who said he did agree with the release of the Pentagon Papers, would be a candidate for heading the Central Intelligence Agency or could possibly be accepted or would want to do it. There was a time when I was on a track that would have brought me in 10 or 20 years to be considered for that. But I certainly left that track. I would no more be able to be nominated or accepted than anyone in the world. It's impossible, and it's impossible that I would want to do it. The commitment to keep secrets from the Congress and from the American people, which is a commitment basically of the Director of Covert Operations, is one that I think no American should make, and I don't respect the fact that Lake is willing to make such a commitment. His claim that he will fully inform the Congress, let alone the public, is belied by the action that Shelby is complaining about in the Bosnia-Iran case a couple of years ago. He showed that he is a candidate to be head of CIA then, but part of that qualification is an ability to lie that subverts democracy, prevents democratic control of foreign policy, and lays the way for many of the kinds of disasters and crimes that we've committed over the years.
Explain what happened back in the 1970s. What happened with Anthony Lake? He was questioned about why he quit Kissinger's staff, Henry Kissinger, who was the National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon. And what was your response at the time?
I think that Lake behaved more creditably, along with four others who left at that time. Mort Halperin is a consultant, but Larry Lynn, Bill Watts, and Roger Morris left the NSC staff along with Lake at that time. They were the only people to resign in response to a policy that was amounted to aggressive war, that was a major deception of the American people at that time, and was pointing toward many more American and Vietnamese deaths. So it was very much to Lake's credit and to the others that they did leave at that time.
Now, as Anthony Lake pointed out, his wife was protesting outside
right.
the White House at the
and
time.
And he said he didn't demonstrate. Well, his wife was doing what she should do. She was doing everything she could as a citizen to protest and dissent from and to expose and to stop this policy. And I think that's the test that any American of that time, certainly everyone who perceived the war as one that was mistaken to continue, and even more the ones who felt it had been mistaken from the start, and was disastrous. Every one of them really has to face the question, what did they do to end the war? What did they do to act on it?
There was, may I just intervene here and say that there was a press account that I read that said that Lake opposed not the invasion itself or its morality or indeed its efficacy, but the deep penetration bombing that was undertaken as part of the invasion.
That was Kissinger's account of it.
Yes.
I don't know. Going individual by individual, I know more about the views of Roger Morris, it so happens. But let me use that to make a distinction here. Morris has said, who was Lake's colleague at the NSC at the time.
And who wrote the book on the Clintons.
And has written a book on Clinton. He's written a book and is writing more volumes of a biography of Nixon. He has said that he was ashamed of the fact, and it was the greatest failure of his life, quote, he felt that they had not had a press conference at the time and fully disclosed their motives, all of their motives, the ones that are in question you just raised, and information as to what Nixon had in mind for Cambodia, Vietnam, North Vietnam, and the rest of us here. They knew, and they kept their promise that they had made improperly, in my opinion, as I had earlier, to keep that secret from the American public. Now, Morris has taken the position that he regrets having done that. He did, in fact, then come to speak out and write very candidly and very strongly against the policy and against other policies. I think that was right. Lake chose to preserve his career, I have to infer, by not doing so, by leaving silently. Now, I do want to give him credit for leaving. Others did not do that. And all these five did more than virtually anybody else. And that's a great qualification, though not for being head of CIA exactly. But their silence did lead, I'd say did contribute, made them complicit in the ensuing deaths, which after all, over some 25,000 Americans died under Nixon, and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese. Not one of them was, every one of those died uselessly on both sides, and they could have helped prevent it. So I'm not saying then that Lake is worse than the run of government officials or than me prior to the time that I did choose to go into full opposition to the war, which included telling what I knew. But I think in this respect, Morris acted later more correctly, and that Morris is right that he felt they should have told what they did at the time. I don't think we should expect from his performance Lake to be more forthcoming about what CIA is doing, either to Congress or to the public. And that reflects the fact, that's why he's a candidate at all and will probably be confirmed as head of the CIA and why his career has continued. And it's why the Directorate of Operations, the covert operations part of CIA, should be abolished. It is incompatible with democracy and the Vietnam War and many other instances, Iran-Contra and I would say the nuclear arms race, reflects the fact that operations that cannot be admitted to the American public should not be done, both to preserve the democracy, but because the democracy protects us from some Jacksons if the facts are known.
Lake said yesterday that he was opposed to U.S. operations in Angola, but then he went on under questioning to say that he was supportive of the invasion of Grenada. Yeah. I would assume he also, which was a highly ill-considered invasion. I would just mention for listeners that today is in fact the anniversary of the 1979 nonviolent revolution by the New Jewel Movement that brought Maurice Bishop and his very valiant followers to power, and they were overthrown in 1983 under the invasion. I would assume Lake also does support the U.S. invasion of Panama, whatever the pretext that were offered, and of course the Gulf War, and we could go on.
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. Save your question because we do have to break. And we come back, we'll continue with Dan Ellsberg. We're here on Democracy Now! And we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Lou Wolf, the co-founder of Covert Action Quarterly, and we're talking to Dan Ellsberg, a man who worked for the State Department, left state in 1967, went over to the RAND Corporation, where he was a consultant for the Pentagon. It was there he got the Pentagon Papers and eventually had them released. Lou, I interrupted your question.
I'm wondering whether, given his support of the invasion of Grenada as an example, his stated support, whether we can worry in the future, if he is DCI, about the militarization, which is already well advanced under John Deutsch, of the CIA. Indeed, it has a vast paramilitary capability on its own, but now working very closely with the Pentagon, what does this mean for the immediate future?
No, I really think that the greater, after all, Grenada was not primarily a CIA intervention, unlike Angola or Nicaragua. I think the thing to worry about above all are the covert operations, which have the special characteristic that they are designed from the very beginning so that the president can lie to the public about his role. Plausible denial means the president can say plausibly with evidence, and you build in this false evidence from the beginning. I didn't know about this. It was done under me somehow, but we weren't involved. The U.S. wasn't involved. Above all, I wasn't involved in situations where those are all lies. Now, if you allow the president to think he has a right to lie, and if you let him get away with that, you are signing away democracy. You're signing away any public sovereignty over foreign policy or any accountability. One of Lake's predecessors here, if he gets to be CIA head, was Richard Helms, who eventually pled guilty to having deceived Congress, misled Congress, about various covert operations.
Which he called a badge of honor.
In particular, Chile, yes. He never served a day in jail. No government official, to my knowledge, has served a day in jail ever for lying to Congress in the most blatant way. Despite the fact that a number of them have actually admitted it subsequently, that this had happened. And so one could very well ask Lake, you say you won't lie to Congress. How will you understand your obligation to keep secrets? Helms said he felt it was his duty to do it. Every CIA official has felt that they had a duty to lie to Congress in this case. That should be changed. And to change that will come very close to abolishing covert operations, and that's what should happen.
We certainly didn't hear this view yesterday. I don't think it'll come as any surprise to anyone that questions of Anthony Lake about perhaps why he didn't hold a news conference, why he left quietly when he left the Vietnam War. Those were not the kind of questions that were asked when he was asked about the Vietnam War. It was to question his honor in resigning.
Well, he of all the candidates for head of CIA, I would say that his former action of resigning gives the American public more assurance than they've ever had from anyone else that under certain circumstances the president could go too far for this man, and he would find that the president, in violating laws, treaties, in committing in many cases impeachable offenses, should be opposed. You should say not only no to him, you should say, I won't let you do that secretly. But, as I say, so long as you have an institution like, in particular, not the intelligence, but the covert operations part of CIA in particular, and you regard that as legitimate and necessary, as Congress does, you are virtually asking for these officials to abort democracy and to lie to you as a congressman.
Well, Dan Ellsberg, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Did it surprise you that Anthony Lake was nominated as Director of Central Intelligence?
He has a better record on the whole than most people who get nominated, a better record of decent attitudes with respect to Africa, for example, which he's been concerned about in the past. But at the same time, he has enough record of keeping his mouth shut about lies and crimes by the government and actually lying to Congress, as in the case of the Iran, of allowing Iran to violate the arms embargo in Bosnia, that he is a candidate in the eyes of right-wingers in the Congress and the administration.
Well, we are going to look at Anthony Lake's record on Africa in the coming week as Anthony Lake continues to have these hearings, or I should say the Senate Intelligence Committee continues to hold these hearings into his confirmation as Director of Central Intelligence. In fact, that is his specialty. Last year, I went over and heard a speech of his on Africa, and he redid his dissertation. What's known as Zimbabwe today was redeemed at the time.
Yeah. I would hope that a nomination someday will occur of a guy who is going to carry out the president's and Congress's will to abolish covert operations. But that day hasn't come.
Well, thank you very much, Dan Ellsberg, and thanks, Lou Wolf, for joining us. We're going to go on with the Lake hearings. Among the questions asked of Anthony Lake at yesterday's CIA hearings were his views about the CIA's so-called scrubbing from its ranks of agents known for their human rights abuses. Reeling from criticism that the CIA regularly hires known killers and death squad leaders, former CIA Director John Deutsch last year ordered a review of who the agency works with. As a result, the CIA reported that some 1,000 informants and agents were released from their employ, including 100 human rights abusers, most of them from Central and South America. Jennifer Harbury, an attorney based in Texas, has had a lot of experience with Guatemala, the CIA, and the Clinton administration over the last several years. She launched an international campaign 5 years ago in search of the truth about the death of her husband, Guatemalan guerrilla leader Comandante Everardo. He was captured, tortured, and killed by Guatemalan military officers, including those on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. And during a break in the hearings yesterday, we got a chance to talk to her. In fact, yesterday was the 5th anniversary of the capture of Everardo. And we asked her what happened on that day.
Well, my husband was captured alive by the Guatemalan army during combat. They took him to an army base and began a very long-term process of torturing him for perhaps a year, perhaps more, in order to break him psychologically and get his information about the resistance forces. He was a very high-level commander, as you've said. There was no information about the resistance forces that he did not know. In order to avoid international outcry from human rights and other legal organizations, they literally faked his death, saying that he'd committed suicide in combat in order to avoid being taken alive. It was only 10 months later when someone escaped from a military base and informed me that, in fact, my husband was alive and under torture, that I was able to start looking for him. And I returned to Guatemala, opened the grave, and found the body of a completely different person. 5 centimeters too short, 15 years too young, different features and completely different dental records. The person had not died in combat. He'd been beaten to death. I repeatedly sought the assistance of State Department officials and was told that they were looking into it, that the Army said that they had never captured my husband, and what else could they do? As you know, this led to 3 hunger strikes on my part, one of which lasted for 32 days, the last one for 12 days, which is when Congressman Torricelli stepped forward and gave me, at last, the truth about my husband's situation. The documents that I found in the file are highly disturbing, the files that I've received from state and from the CIA. By way of example, 6 days after my husband's 1992 capture, the CIA did send a bulletin to both the State Department and also to the National Security Council, also to the White House, which would have been routed to the National Security Council, informing them that my husband had been captured alive and that the Army would probably fake his death to better take advantage of his situation, and things went from there. What I've learned from the files is that the White House, the State Department, and the CIA were informed immediately that my husband had been taken as a prisoner of war and was being secretly detained, and that his death was being falsified. We also know from a number of sources, including the Intelligence Oversight Board report, that when he was detained secretly, he was in the hands of more than one CIA asset, including Colonel Julio Roberto Altidez, a School of the Americas graduate and a paid informant for the CIA. Apparently, he was not the only one. We know that my husband was tortured for a long time, drugged repeatedly by Army physicians, and eventually placed in a full body cast to avoid his escape. After approximately a year of this sort of abuse, he was extrajudicially executed, and his body was left in an unmarked grave, which I am still trying to locate and exhume. Perhaps the most disturbing thing are throughout the files are the repeated reports of, yes, there are secretly detained prisoners, many of them in Guatemala. The official line, of course, was that there was no independent evidence that such secret prisoners exist. There is a report with all names blacked out that military officials did indicate when I first started searching for my husband in 1993 that he was still alive, and that information was not passed on to me. It was not passed on to Congress. The official line is, we're trying to find out what happened to him, but we don't know. It was only when Mike Wallace came forward in the 60 Minutes broadcast at the end of 1994, when I had gone some 32 days without eating in front of the National Palace, that we got part of the information that, yes, he had been captured alive. Yes, he was a secret prisoner of war for a while. I still was unable to get the rest of the story until Congressman Torricelli came forward after my March 1995 hunger strike in front of the White House and was able to tell me the truth about his death. At that point, it was March 1995. I'd been looking for him since early 1993, going again and again and again to any U.S. official I could get my meetings with, you know, trying to get any information or any support from them, and was literally left to do 3 highly dangerous hunger strikes and go in and out of Guatemala under death threats and risks of being assassinated for several years without any real reason therefore.
We're talking to Jennifer Harbury, who is describing her ordeal over the last 5 years since her husband, Comandante Everardo, was taken by the Guatemalan military, tortured, and eventually killed. Now, Jennifer, today and yesterday, there was a mention of the scrubbing that the CIA has done, and that is the getting rid of about, 1,000 CIA agents around the world. Most of them, they say, just because they're ineffective, but about 100 of them because they're involved with murder and torture and assassination, and they are largely concentrated in Central America. And I think the reason the CIA came forward and said they were doing this was probably in large part because of you and all the publicity and the light that you've shed on what the CIA is doing. What do you think of the scrubbing? Maxine Waters is concerned that it's going to delete names, that along with getting rid of the agents, they're going to get rid of any evidence of what they have done.
Well, I have very similar concerns. I think scrubbing is all fine and well, but this is information about very serious criminal activities. You know, we're talking about the Charles Mansons of this hemisphere. Highly serious criminal activity that have resulted in thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, civilians, being massacred and tortured and kidnapped at the most grotesque level of human rights abuses. Is it enough to simply remove them from our payroll? I don't think so. What we're dealing with here is a question of ethics and obstruction of justice. The family members need to know what happened to their relatives. The information needs to be released to the courts, and the people responsible need to go to jail. If they don't go to jail, if there are no consequences for the truly horrifying acts that they have committed, then more people are going to be killed, and that includes U.S. citizens, as it has all along.
Let me ask you the question that I just asked to our previous guest, and that is, if you were sitting in one of these vinyl-backed, maybe even their leather seats that each senator and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence sits in as they question Anthony Lake, the possible new director of intelligence, what would you ask Anthony Lake?
Do you feel that it is correct and appropriate to withhold information about serious human rights criminal activities?
Jennifer Harbury speaking to us during the Central Intelligence Agency hearings, the confirmation hearings for Anthony Lake to be director of Central Intelligence yesterday. Jennifer Harbury has a new book that she's just written that's been published by Warner Books called Searching for Everardo. And today she continues to search for Everardo's bones to find out where he's buried and continues to question the U.S. government, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the State Department about what they know about where he is in Guatemala. Well, Jennifer Harbury's name did come up yesterday at the hearings. They came up because Senator Frank Lautenberg, Democrat of New Jersey, questioned Anthony Lake about the policy of hiring human rights abusers.
Pursuing the question that Senator DeWine asked just in another direction, if a relationship is entered with contact, asset, as they're typically described, And then it's discovered that there have been tactics used on the other side that violate what we would consider acceptable standards for our interest. Guatemala, the cover-up, the Guatemalan army's murder of American Michael Devine, death of the husband of American Jennifer Harbury, which got a fair amount of attention in my statements. Harbury, who was there for some time. How do you then decide or expedite a termination of a relationship? What do you do? Do you go in and lecture the offending country and say, hey, that's not nice, and you're in the middle of a flow of information. The contact has a degree of significant importance. What happens in a situation like that? How is this strictly a subjective analysis? You can't have a guidebook that says, okay, if they do six things under column A, and we put in the computer, the program says bad boy or bad country or what have you. How do you deal with something like that?
I don't believe most of these people are susceptible to verbal guidance. And their histories show that. I think that Senator DeWine got it exactly right in listing some of the criteria you use, essentially balancing the value of their information to the national interest and potentially to the lives of Americans against the degree to which they have behaved in ways that we find unacceptable. And that is a judgment that is, in the end, I suppose, subjective, but we have very clear criteria in deciding each side of that ledger. If, in fact, they have committed deeds or are committing deeds, or we have reason to believe that they will commit deeds that we find intolerable, especially, as I said, if they are actions that damage our national interest or the lives of American citizens, the response is not to go and lecture them. The response is to terminate them forthwith.
as these things don't always fit on a nice balance scale, obviously. There can't be some, to exaggerate a little bit, a puritanical standard by which we measure.
That's Senator Frank Lautenberg, Democrat of New Jersey, questioning Anthony Lake in the midst of his confirmation hearings to be Director of Central Intelligence. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also call that number if you'd like to get a copy of that mug. If you'd like to get the mug and send it to the White House that says President Clinton, Coffee, Tea, and Me. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Errol Maitland, our engineer, Kenneth Mason, our executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!